Good afternoon, San Marcos. Good afternoon, Planet Earth. Welcome to another episode of Philosophy and Popular Music. I am your host, Paul Wilson, and today I've got two good friends of mine in the studio with me. We're doing a focus on, well, broadly speaking, both of my guests have played with country artists, and I've got Mr. Alan Colby from San Antonio, Texas, and Mr. Paul McLaughlin from New Braunfels, Texas. We are going to play some songs from the artists that they have done gigs with, played guitar with. Paul has played guitar and piano with some of the artists we'll talk about, and Alan Colby has been the lead guitarist and band leader from some of the artists we'll be looking at. And what we do on this show is we talk about the music business, and I'll let my guests give a little bit of history about their background, and then we get into some philosophizing about the music business. So I'm going to turn first to Mr. Paul McLaughlin, who we just heard a song, one of Jerry Reed's finest songs. Paul, you want to tell us about your stint with Jerry Reed in G-rated language?
I had a very brief stint with Jerry Reed. I played 4 months, which I think was 4 gigs, on piano when his wife, Priscilla Mitchell, fell off the stage at the Hall of Fame in College Station and broke both elbows.
Oh, no.
And so I was pressed into service as the piano player for a brief while.
And what kind of did you play across the country? Did you play? Tell us about the gigs that you played in that four-month tenure.
Oh, they were close. One in Oklahoma. We did New Mexico, Oklahoma, Louisiana, and a couple in Texas. That was about it. I didn't ride on the bus. I drove the same pickup I still drive to the gigs. Although it's a much more broken in now, and the seats are more forgiving.
Alan Colby, let's talk about your beginning of your music career. You're a Vietnam vet, and the rest of your career, you played professional music. And let's talk about your career with Tanya Tucker.
Well, I went with Tanya in '74. That was kind of like during her first reign of terror, and it was great. Everything that we were out doing shows, and just about everything she did was at least a top 10, if not a number one record. So on stage, it was just wonderful. It was, we were only playing big venues, state fairs, and big clubs, and it was really fun. The stage thing was great, and once we got on the bus, it was sort of like entering the Twilight Zone. But the music part was just great.
We're gonna do a song of Tanya's now. This is her big hit, Delta Dawn.
Delta Dawn, what's that power you have?
Right, and we're back, Philosophy and Popular Music. I've got my guests, Alan Colby and Paul McLaughlin. I've got a sort of a playlist here of these tunes, and I guess I'll just go in the order of my playlist here. Alan, tell us about your career with Jim Stafford. First of all, for folks who might not know who Jim Stafford is, give us a little background about him. He's both a actor and a country singer, and well, tell us about him and tell us about your career with him.
Yeah, well, he's a phenomenal guitar player and entertainer. He's from Florida, and they moved to L.A. He ran into a guy named Phil Gernhardt, who produced Spiders and Snakes and Swamp Witch. I believe they did that in Atlanta. And then they ended up in L.A., and I went with him in '76. I was his band leader for 2 years after I left Barbie Benton, and it was great to work with Jim. It was so professional, and of course half of his show was music, and the other half was sort of a circus freak act because he was so funny, and we used to do stuff to him all the time and try to trick him up, and we'd do things that if you did it to anybody else in the world, you'd never play a musical instrument again. But it never stopped him. No matter what he did, we'd be in the middle of a show in Vegas showroom or something and pull some kind of a stunt, and he wouldn't know it was happening, but he would just treat it like we'd rehearsed it for 3 years. He was so great at that kind of stuff. He was just phenomenal. He's a great guy to work with.
Let's hear Spiders and Snakes. Steve, you want to do the commercials now? And we're back. Philosophy and Popular Music, Episode 3. I am your host, Paul Wilson. I've got my guests, Alan Colby and Paul McLaughlin. Paul McLaughlin, you did a stint with a woman named Jeannie C. Riley, who had a big hit called Harper Valley PTA. Tell us about Jeannie. Tell us about the song, the TV show, and all this history, would you?
Yes, I would. she had one big hit. That was Harper Valley PTA. She actually did a really cool follow-up to it called O Singer, but it never got played as far as I know. I mean, didn't get the kind of success that Harper Valley did. Harper Valley was a great big hit, and 3 years later, we were asking the crowd, y'all want to hear that a fourth time? And they would usually say, no, please, no. But she was and is a very fine lady, except for one day when she fired me in Enid, Oklahoma on the main square, and I was forced to wear a white leisure suit for several days until I could get up enough money to come to the San Marcos bus station and get picked up by my grandmother, who actually thought I was a sailor. It's another story. Jeannie C. became an evangelist, and I walked into the Hall of Fame in Nashville. The old Hall of Fame was up on top of the hill on Music Row, and there was a theater inside the front door, and I walked in there just looking around one day, and to my horror, Jeannie C. Riley was giving a sermon. And I kind of hid in the back, and she came back and said, I'm not sorry that I fired you, but now I'm sorry, you know, personally and all that.
Oh, well, that was nice of her.
Yeah, she was a nice lady.
Well, let's hear her big hit, Harper Valley PTA. Here we go.
Oh, let's go.
And we're back. Philosophy and Popular Music with your host, Paul Wilson. I'm here with my friends, Alan Colby and Paul McLaughlin. My next song up on my playlist, Paul, is the great B.J. Thomas. This is actually the only thing I could find on Spotify. It's a live version of one of his great hits. But would you like to tell us about your career with B.J.?
Yeah, he was a hero of mine. When I was a kid growing up, there was very little talking done that had anything to do with the song. KTSA in San Antonio was the big rock station when I was a kid. And B.J. Thomas's first hit that I recall was I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry, which he sang, you know, did you hear that lonesome whippoorwill, you know, did all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that was the greatest thing I ever heard. And many years later, I wound up by default with him. He had four bands. He had one on the West Coast, one on the East Coast, and one in Chicago, and one in Texas. And the band in Texas happened to be at that time a band that I had played with for a long time. And so he only does 10 songs, and he doesn't fly a band anywhere. I mean, whatever the nearest band is, at least in 1995, that's the band that he used. BJ was is the best singer I ever met, and I think he's 76 or 77 now, and he's still doing Dairy Queen commercials. You know, DQ.
Yeah,
that's what I like about Texas. Mm-hmm. I mean, he still sings like a bird. I mean, big old bird. I just really enjoyed it. One of the reasons that he hired me was that I play the trumpet too, and two of his songs have trumpets in them, so it saved a deal. But the funniest thing, he starts every show off with I'm Hooked on a Feeling, mm-hmm. which back in the 60s, you guys might remember that there was a lot of sitar played because George Harrison chose to play the sitar.
Right.
So they came out with a cheesy little electric guitar called a choral sitar, just a little lousy guitar, and it sounded like a sitar. And the intro to that song, I believe Reggie Young recorded.
Yeah, Reggie did that.
He did a lot of that kind of stuff back in the day. But it's a long intro. It's only 8 bars, but there's a lot of notes. Bang, 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 bang. The first time I met him, I played it on a guitar with a phase shifter, and it sounded pretty close. And he literally stopped the band and said, you know, if I'd have known that, I could have saved a whole lot of money. And you come along now when the song's wore out. So anyhow.
Well, I don't have that one queued up. I do have one. I remember I used to play in Alan Colby's band, Nightfire, and I can't remember what we were talking about, Alan, but the thing that you said was, I don't like major seventh chords. Well, this is one of BJ's hits written by Burt Bacharach, and it's a live version of Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head. Here we go.
You can sing this one too.
Thank you.
me.
And we are back, KZSM.org, San Marcos. We're here with my show, Philosophy and Popular Music, with my guests, Alan Colby and Paul McLaughlin. Now, the next thing we're going to get to, I've got to switch modes here a bit. And Alan, why don't you tell us about your career with Barbie Benton?
Yeah, well, I did 10 months with Tanya, and then she fired the whole band. And I was not going to go back on the road. I was going to stay in Nashville. And she was in town doing Hee Haw. And she put she had the record Brass Buckles come out, and she was putting a road band together in L.A. And she had some really good players, but she didn't have anybody with any road experience or leader experience. So Bobby Thompson on Hee Haw, he was in the staff band, told her to call me. And her and her manager called me up and told me what they wanted to do. And said, well, come on down and meet Barbie. And I said, well, I just don't really want to go on the road anymore. And they said, well, I'll just come down and meet Barbie. And I figured, well, there's worse things to do. So I went downtown Nashville, and I met him in the hotel and got to talking to him. And they said, well, we want you to go out in L.A. and do this. And I said, well, I've been on the road. I get fired all the time. We all get fired all the time, as Paul can attest to. I said, all right, if I do it, I want this much money, and I'm not going to give up my place in Nashville. And that was when Barbie said, well, that's okay. Just stay at the house. And I'm thinking, what house? And she said, the Playboy Mansion. I said, okay, I'll give it a shot. So they flew me to L.A. They put me up at the Beverly Hilton the first two nights. And then we stayed in the drummer that she had, and I stayed, and she had an apartment in Beverly Hills. We stayed there for about a week or so, and then I moved into the Playboy Mansion guest house and stayed there for a year. And so I was her band leader and arranged everything. We put the band together, and we're on the road. And it was a lot of fun. And a lot of people don't understand Barbie because, you know, she had that crazy hee-haw act and stuff, but she's really, really very smart. And she speaks something like five languages. Huh. And I was in L.A. a couple of years ago talking to meeting our old piano player, and he reminded me of something. He said, you know, Barbie, she loved the band. She was like a mother hen. Yeah. You know, we were all older than she was, but yeah. She was like, man, she called us her boys.
Yeah.
And she took care of us no matter what happened. It was really great. And we flew everywhere, fly around in a Playboy bunny jet and all this stuff. And
wow.
Yeah, it was fun. I've had worse gigs.
I can't believe Hef didn't tell me about that.
All right, now Alan sent me some audio. This is some songs that Alan himself is playing on. So we're going to play a couple of songs. This was so Barbie did an album in Japan. This is from Live in Japan. What did she have a following there? Tell us about this album, Alan.
I guess she did. You know, we just went over there and we were there 2 weeks. We played 12 shows in 2 weeks. All around the country, did a live album and two or three television shows, so we didn't sleep a whole lot. But yeah, she did good. But Barbie's as funny as she's as smart as she is. She says some crazy things. So she'd go out in the audience and she'd sit on some guy's lap and she'd start singing, "I honestly love you," and then she would start doing some of it in Spanish. And I'm thinking, we're in Japan, and then we're doing this other song, and she's sitting on this Japanese guy lap, and all of a sudden she said, "How'd you get such a beautiful tan?" And I'm thinking, we're in Japan. But anyway, we did this live album.
Nuclear energy.
Yeah, it was kind of fun. You know, we're all over the country in a bullet train and all that, so it was good. It was just a good old time.
Here's Barbie's big hit, Brass Buckles.
My current single, and it's called Brass Buckles.
Well, that's a catchy song. I never heard it until 2 days ago when we talked about it, and I've got it down now. So. Yeah. That's the mark of a good song. All right, now this is the part of the program where we philosophize about music. So you guys have been in the business since you were young men, and you've made pretty much your entire career has been as a professional musician. So tell us about Nashville. Tell us about the country music industry. Tell us, you know, what are the goods and bads about it? Alan, why don't you go first?
Well, I got lucky. I went to Nashville in 74 when it was still pretty much run by musicians. Mm-hmm. You know, it was Chet Atkins and Bradley and those guys. So I caught a break there. It was a lot of fun. I got really lucky by sort of stumbling into the jobs I was able to stumble into, as many great players as there are in that town. And so I did the road from 74 through the end of 78, and then went back to Nashville and stayed there till 86 when I moved back to Florida, which is where I'm from. But I kind of saw a change coming, because I used to do a lot of publishing company demos, play on tons of demos. And I remember when MTV came along, and I saw the writing on the wall that before then you had one speaker in a car, and you had a great song, a great artist, and a great record, or somebody's going to push the button and go to the next station. Mm-hmm. And then when MTV came around and it started getting to be videos, I remember doing demos with some writers, and these are great writers. These guys have written half the hits you probably have heard. But one of them once said to me, "Oh man, I can see the video now." And I'm thinking, "Oh, this is the end. This is where it's going to end." You know? Mm-hmm. And they kind of stopped writing songs and started writing 3-minute soundtracks, you know, for little movies. And so I bailed. I'd had enough. 13 years between there and LA, and just went back to Florida.
Mm-hmm. Paul, what about you? What's your take on the music business? The goods, the bads, the changes?
Well, everything in Nashville now has got a Sony in front of it. I wrote some things that Tree did, and now it's Sony Tree, and the whole block that used to be RCA became Mike Curb, and I think it's mostly torn down now. They saved a few of the historic buildings. Mm-hmm. The old Studio B, where all those great songs, Marty Robbins, Jim Reeves, Eddie Arnold, where all those songs were recorded, that's a museum now. Mm-hmm. And that surprises me. I had a daughter, my youngest daughter, Shannon, worked for the Tennessee Titans 2007, and I took her out there, or met her there. She came from Florida, and I took her up to Music Row to show her around, and I couldn't find my way around. All those old dirt utility easements that, you know, you can't park on a street on Music Row. You have to park in the dirt easement behind it, mm-hmm. especially if it's a bus or a musician. So those are all paved now. They have names like Chet Atkins Way. Mm-hmm. And things like that, which I don't know, it's too much for me. But the other side of that is, I used to hang out a little bit with a guy named Bobby Braddock, who I knew he was a great piano player. I didn't know who he was. Turns out that we were swapping songs one night at the little bar there called the Bluebird, and he starts playing the piano, and I ask him why he sounded so familiar, and he said, "Well, I've played many years with Marty Robbins." But I kind of got some success as a songwriter, and I just decided to write. I said, "Well, what have you written?" O-D-I-V-O-R-C-E, He Stopped Loving Her, wow. Today with Curly Putnam.
Wow.
Which was the song of the year.
Twice.
Yeah, I mean, unbelievable. Of course, needless to say, I never wrote anything like that. You know, I wrote songs that Mel Tillis tried to sue me for. And the bottom line was, when Sony came to town, they doubled his commission. Now, he was getting 5 or 6 cents, whatever, a cut, and they doubled it. Mm. And he went from barely making ends meet and keeping several ex-wives in houses to being in pretty good shape. And it was because Sony bought in. So there are reasons for this. And there are people who choose not to go that direction. That's my take on Nashville. And I tried to go back in 94, and Steve Hennig said to me, Steve Hennig is a music producer at Fisher Studios here in Comal County. But Steve had a studio at 17th and Church called Meadowland. And he said, "Don't come back. Number one, you can't cut it here anymore. Brent Mason and people like that play here now. And secondly," he said, "you couldn't afford to buy the rack. These guys had locker-sized racks mm-hmm. of effects. When I went to Nashville the first time, you had an Echoplex and a Pig Nose amp. And if you wanted to distort, you used the Pig Nose, and the Echoplex, you put a towel over it so the mic didn't pick up the noise of the tape passing, the physical noise of the yep. tape passing over the heads. So, you know, a lot of that has to do with the fact that you and I are old.
That's true.
And Steve is, I think, probably, what, 20?
Me?
Two. Yeah. And I know for a fact that Paul is 19 years younger than me.
Which makes me 26. Still pretty old. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, Bobby Braddock, he's another Florida boy. He's a great guy. Everybody likes Bobby.
We're going to do another take from Barbie's live album. This features Alan playing guitar on it. This is good old Rocky Top, Rocky Top, Tennessee. And we are back. Philosophy and Popular Music. I'm here with my friends Alan Colby and Paul McLaughlin, and we're talking about the country music industry. I think we might have time for one more song before the break. Now this is, yeah, okay. Well, this is a song that Paul played his part of his career with Jimmy Buffett, and I'm gonna pull up this song first. The song was called what again, Paul?
Livingston Saturday Night.
Livingston Saturday Night.
He did two versions of it.
Yes. And the one I'm looking for is the one, not this one, but this one, correct? Rancho Deluxe. Here we go. Yeah. Paul McLaughlin is playing B3 on this version of Livingston Saturday Night. Here we go.
Yeah, now we're just a rocking and a rolling.
You are listening to Philosophy and Popular Music. I'm your host, Paul Wilson. Philosophy and Popular Music is made possible in part by the Texas State Department of Philosophy, Texas State University Department of Philosophy, in affiliation with the Philosophy Dialogue Series. Join the conversation. We just heard one of Jimmy Buffett's versions of Livingston Saturday Night. Paul McLaughlin played the B3 organ on that song. Paul, tell us the story about that song. Tell us about how you co-wrote that song.
Well, I wrote four lines of that song. Well,
it's still mailbox money.
Yeah, well, it's not actually, but I mean, who couldn't live on $33 a month? In New Braunfels, you can't, and you just can't live in a house. The original guitar player with Buffett was a guy named Roger Bartlett, and they were a duo for a while. I mean, Jimmy was the name, and Roger played guitar. And then he began adding a band, Harry Daly on bass and Phil Fajardo on drums, and other people came and went. But in, I don't know, 73 or 74, I was going to the University of Texas, which is a smaller college up the road in Austin, and got a call, said Livingston, Montana, and be in a movie. And of course I did, because it might involve, you know, connubial relations with young women. So I went up there, and we were all going to play in a bar scene. Buffett had a song that began, the title began with Why Don't We Get Drunk, and yes. And he had, I think Come Monday was out by then. But
that's a much more pleasant song.
He was going mm-hmm. to be in a bar scene, and he said, well, you guys, we won't really be playing. We'll be playing the song, but we won't be plugged in. We'll use the track. So we get up there, and right before we went inside, the producer said, now, you guys all got your Screen Actors Guild cards, don't you? And, of course, none of us even knew. I thought he was talking about a door, you know, a screen door. Well, the only one who did was Buffett. So they went back in the bar, and a bunch of regulars were in the bar, and he said, how many of you guys got cards? Of course, everybody did. So they just picked out four guys and stood them up on the stage behind him. And if you ever see the movie, it's called Rancho Deluxe.
Starring
Sam Waterston and
Jeff Bridges,
and also who was the cowboy I was telling you about? Slim Pickens.
Right.
It's a great movie. You should rent that movie. It's $1.99 on Netflix. and that's because of how popular it was. I think those two guys were 26, 7 years old. Buffett's standing up on stage for most of a song, and then they cut away to a scene in another room. But you see these guys on stage who look like they're waxing those guitars. I mean, it's just the goofiest thing in the world, and probably get sued for that. But hopefully Thomas McGuain is not listening. Thomas McGuain and Buffett married, well, they were brother-in-laws. McGuain married Buffett's sister. McGuain wrote a series of novels, including Rancho Deluxe. He was living in Key West, writing movies about Travis McGee, a detective, the Cedar Key detective series. And he got sick of Key West, and he moved to Montana and decided he'd write a song about Livingston, Montana. And Buffett had three songs with the word Livingston in them. He had a great, great song about his old roommate from in Mississippi that moved to Lubbock, Texas to ride bulls. And he wrote a song called Livingston's Gone to Texas. Wonderful song. Then there's two versions of the one you heard. One version is that one, and the other version was on one of the albums, and it was done with Reggie Young, who did most of the early stuff with Buffett. So I got a free trip to Montana and got to see what snow was.
He got to go to Montana, and I got stuck at the Playboy Mansion.
Yeah, damn it. You know, you actually went to Japan, I believe you told us, too.
Uh-huh.
I think that's a little more exotic than any place I ever played, although I almost went to Ethiopia, but it didn't work out. They couldn't get the money together.
Paul, I'm going to interject here. And did you tell us how you ended up writing a line? Buffett came to
He didn't write a song, and it was implicit that Buffett would do the whole soundtrack for that movie. It just didn't occur to him that he would have to have new songs.
Yeah.
You know, he would just use his songs. I think he had three albums out. Well, he had two terrible albums out, and then he began his string of great albums. The first two albums are, you can find them in used bins, trying to be country. But the theme that they told him to write the song about was basically, it's Saturday night and this is the only bar in town, so that's where everybody is. Well, that's not true in Livingston, Montana, but that was the theme. So we went out to the truck, sat on the tailgate. Buffett had a 1959 or 60 Chevrolet short wheelbase stepside pickup that he took everywhere. It didn't have a hood latch. A lot of times going down the highway, the hood would just come open, you know, which was pretty cool. And sat on the tailgate, and my contribution was, it's Saturday night, we just got paid. With any luck at all, you might even get laid cruising and a-boozing on a Livingston Saturday night. That's it.
And that gets you how much mailbox money a year or a quarter?
I don't know, because they don't issue a check till it gets to $25.
And, okay.
No. I'm thinking maybe when I'm about 80 years old, I get a check for $25. But
let's philosophize some more of the time we have remaining. So tell us, where do you think the music industry in general is heading? Where do you think country music is? You know, Alan and I play gigs together still, and we recently got acquainted with a group called Midland, and I like them quite a bit. I think Alan does too, and they're kind of reminiscent of old country acts. They have that country essence about them, but most of the country artists now don't. What do you think about where country music is heading, the industry, the sound, all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I don't really recognize anything as country, because we were talking earlier, I grew up playing mostly black music. We called it soul music in those days. It was Sam and Dave and Wilson Pickett, Otis Redding and Aretha and those kind of people. And then when I ended up in Nashville, I started playing country, and I got to really appreciate it, mostly for the songs.
Mm-hmm.
The guys that were writing those songs, and you listen to them now, they're phenomenal songs.
Yeah.
Great stories, and not just stories, but songs. But now, listen to this stuff right now, there is no melody. You know, one or two notes is not a melody. And something sort of imitating a real bad kick drum on a computer is not a band. It's kind of just rambling. It's just sort of like a guy just, well, I woke up this morning and I got out of bed and then I had some coffee and then I went down to the store and then I came home. There's not really any kind of a song there or anything to me.
Yeah.
Of course, it could be just because I'm old, but I just don't hear it.
Well, what do you think about contemporary music, be it country or pop music in general? Do you have any thoughts about along those lines?
I don't know anything at all about pop music. I play solo from time to time, and it occurred to me the last gig I did that I don't know a song newer than 1978. So I said, and it's not because I don't like them, it's just because I don't know where you'd go find one.
Yeah.
So I asked people, what do you listen to? Well, because most of the humans on Earth are younger than me, they don't listen to the ones I want to know. But if you go about 80 miles due northeast of here to Granger, Texas on a Sunday afternoon, you can hear the best country band you ever heard in your life.
Really?
Called the Cat Hardly Playboys.
Yeah.
Fronted by Bubba Cox. And we were talking earlier about Bobby Witten. Mm-hmm. One of the best guitar players who ever lived was Bobby Witten, and is Bobby Witten, who plays with that band. Bobby played on the road for many years with Mel Tillis. He played on the road with Dottie West, others in Nashville. He and Kenny Penny usually were twin lead guitars. And Bobby Witten is still blazing. Leroy Eichler, George Strait's number one road crew guy that drives George's personal bus, plays drums. A guy named Billy Barr plays bass. Steve Palusik plays steel, probably the best steel player that ever lived on this earth. Just phenomenally good. Don Raby plays fiddle. And a guy named David Kyle plays the piano. Any Sunday afternoon, I think it goes 5 till midnight. Great band.
I'd like to thank my guests, my good friends, Alan Colby and Paul McLaughlin, for coming in this afternoon. Thank you for listening. Have a great afternoon, Planet Earth and San Marcos.